HID support brothers and sisters, or the YYY engineer, or Uncle Bud on a roof, or her stepmother in the locked ward, or her poor personal daddy again, is sentimental and banal. The idea of what she's about in here contains all other ideas and makes them banal. Her glass of juice is on the back of the toilet, half empty. The back of the toilet is lightly sheened with condensation of unknown origin. These are facts. This room in this apartment is the sum of very many specific facts and ideas. There is nothing more to it than that. Deliberately setting about to make her heart explode has assumed the status of just one of these facts. It was an idea, but now is about to become a fact. The closer it comes to becoming concrete, the more abstract it seems. Things get very abstract. The concrete room was the sum of abstract facts. Are facts abstract, or are they just abstract representations of concrete things? Molly Notkin's middle name is Cantrell. Joelle puts two more matches together and prepares to strike them, breathing rapidly in and out like a diver preparing for a long descent.
I say, is someone in there?
The voice is the young post-new formalist from Pittsburgh who affects continental and wears an ascot that won't stay tight. With that hesitant knocking of when you know perfectly well someone's in there, the bathroom door composed of 36, that's 3 times a lengthwise 12, recessed, 2 beveled squares, in a warped rectangle of steam-softened wood, not quite white. The bottom outside corner right here, raw wood, and mangled from hitting the cabinet's bottom drawer's wicked metal knob. Through the door and offset red, and glowering actors and calendar, and very crowded scene, and pubic spiral of pale blue smoke, from the elephant-colored rubble of ash, and little blackened chunks in the foil funnel's cone. The smoke's baby blanket blue that sent her sliding down along the wall past knotted washcloth, towel rack, blood flower wallpaper, and intricately grimed electrical outlet. The light, sharp, bitter tint of a heated sky's blue that's left her uprightly fetal with chin on knees in yet another North American bathroom. De-veiled, too pretty for words, maybe the prettiest girl of all time. Prettiest G-O-A-T. Knees to chest, slew-footed by the radiant chill of the claw-footed tub's porcelain. Molly's had somebody lacquer the tub in blue lacquer. She's holding the bottle, recalling vividly its slogan for the last generation was "The choice of a nude generation," when she was of back-pocket height and prettier by far than any of the peach-colored titans they'd gazed up at. His hand in her lap, her hand in the box, and rooting down past candy for the prize. More fun, way too much fun, inside her veil on the counter above her. The stuff in the funnel exhausted, though it's still smoking thinly, its graph reaching its highest spiked prick, peak, the arrow's best descent, so good she can't stand it, and reaches out for the cold tub's rim's cold edge to pull herself up, as the white party noise reaches for her, the sort of stereophonic precipice of volume, to teeter on just before the speakers blow, people barely twitching, and conversations strettoing against a ghastly old pre-Carter thing saying, "We've only just begun." Joelle's limbs have been removed to a distance where their acknowledgement of her commands seems like magic. Both clogs simply gone, nowhere in sight, and socks oddly wet. Pulls her face up to face the unclean medicine cabinet mirror. Twin roses of flame still hanging in the glasses corner. Hair of the flame she's eaten now trailing like the legs of wasps through the air of the glass she uses to locate the defaced veil and what's inside it. Loading up the cone again, the ashes from the last load make the world's best filter. This is a fact. Breathes in and out like a savvy diver.
"Look here, then. Who's that in there? Is someone in there? Do open up. I'm on one foot, then the other out here. I say, Notkin, someone's been in here, locked in and, well, sounding unwell. I mean, rather a queer scent."
And is knelt, vomiting over the lip of the cool blue tub, gouges on the tub's lip revealing sandy white gritty stuff below the lacquer and porcelain, vomiting muddy juice and blue smoke and dots of mercuric red into the claw-footed trough, and can hear again and seems to see, against the fire of her closed lid's blood, bladed vessels aloft in the night to monitor flow, searchlit helicopters, fat fingers of blue light from one sky, searching. Enfield, Massachusetts, is one of the stranger little facts that make up the idea that is Metro Boston, because it is a township composed almost entirely of medical, corporate, and spiritual facilities. A kind of arm shape extending north from Commonwealth Avenue and separating Brighton into upper and lower, its elbow nudging East Newton's ribs and its fist sunk into Alston, Enfield's broad municipal tax base includes St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Franciscan Children's Hospital, the Universal Bleacher Company, the Provident Nursing Home, Shuco Mist Medical Pressure Systems Incorporated, the Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital Complex, the Svelte Nail Company, half the Metro Boston turbine and generating stations of Sunstrand Power and Light, the part that gets taxed is in Incorporated Alston, corporate headquarters for the ATH-SCME family of air displacement effectuators, meaning they make really big fans, the Enfield Tennis Academy, St. John of God Hospital, Hahnemann Orthopedic Hospital, the Leisure Time Ice Company, a discalced monastery, the combined St. John Seminary and offices for the RCC's Boston Archdiocese, partly in Upper Brighton, neither half-taxed, convent headquarters of the Sisters for Africa, the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation, the Dr. George Roebling Runyon Memorial Institute for Podiatric Research, regional shiny truck, lion barge, and catapult facilities for the ONAN-subsidized Empire Waste Displacement Company, what the Quebecois call Lettre Boucher Noir, spectacular block-long catapults that make a sound like a giant stamping foot as they fling great twine-bundled waste vehicles into the subannular regions of the Great Concavity at a parabolic altitude exceeding 5 kilometers. The device's slings are of alloy-belted elastic, and they're huge cupped vehicle receptacles like catcher's mitts from hell. A half dozen or so of the catapults in this blimp, hangarish thing with a selectively slide-backable roof, taking up a good 6 square blocks of Enfield's Brackerform incursion into the Alston Spur, occasional school tours tolerated but not encouraged, and so on. With the whole flexed Enfield limb sleeved in a perimeter layer of light residential and mercantile properties. The Enfield Tennis Academy occupies probably now the nicest site in Enfield. Some 10 years after balding and shaving flat, the top of the big abrupt hill that constitutes a kind of raised cyst on the township's elbow. The better part of 75 hectares of broad lawns and clover-leafing paths and topologically cutting-edge erections, 32 asphalt tennis courts and 16 hard-true composition tennis courts, and extensive underground maintenance and storage and athletic training facilities and briars and calliopsis and pines mixed artfully in on the inclines with deciduous trees. The ETA hilltop overlooking on one side, east, historic Commonwealth Avenue's acclivated migration out of the squalor of Lower Brighton. Liquor stores and laundromats and bars and palisades of somber and guano-dappled tenement facades. The huge and brooding Brighton Project high-rises with 3-story-high orange ID numerals on the side, plus liquor stores, and pale men in leather, and whole gangs of pale children in leather on the corners, and Greek-owned pizza places with yellow walls and dirty corner markets owned by Orientals, who try like heck to keep their sidewalks clean, but can't, even with hoses, plus the quarter-hourly trundle and ding of the Green Line trains labor up the avenue's long rise to Boston College, into the spiky elegance of Boston College and the broad gentrification of Newton out to the west, where the haze-haloed Boston sun drops behind the last node in the 4-kilometer sine wave that is collectively called the historic April Marathon's Heartbreak Hill, the sun always setting 15 minutes to the nanosecond after DeLint turns on the quartz high tower lights. 2, I think it must be the southwest, ETA overlooks the steely gray tangle of sun strands transformers and high-voltage grids and coaxial chokers strung with beads of ceramic insulators, with not one sun strand smokestack anywhere in sight, but a monstrous mega-ohm insulator cluster at the terminus of a string of signs trailing in from the northeast, each sign talking with many zeros about how many annular generated amps are waiting underground for anyone who digs, or in any way, dicks around, with hair-raising nonverbal stick-figure symbols of somebody with a shovel going up like a Kleenex in a fireplace. There are smokestacks in the visual background slightly south of Sunstrand, though, from the EWD hangars, each stack with a monstrous ATH-SCME 2100 series ADE fan bolted behind it and blowing due north, with an insistent high-pitched fury that is somehow soothing, orally, at ETA's distance and height. From both the north and northeast tree lines, ETA looks down its hill's steepest, best-planted decline into the complexly decaying grounds of Enfield Marine. The 5th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The transparent phone sounded from somewhere under the hill of bedding as Hal was on the edge of the bed with one leg up and his chin on its knee, clipping his nails into a wastebasket that sat several meters away in the middle of the room.
82.
It took 4 rings to find the receiver in the bedding and pull the antenna out. Yellow. Mr. Incandenza, this is the Enfield Raw Sewage Commission, and quite frankly, we've had enough shit out of you. Hello, Warren. How hangs it, kid? God, please no. Please, oh, no more separatism questions. Relax, never crossed my mind. Social call. Shoot the breeze. Interesting you should call just now, because I'm clipping my toenails into a wastebasket several meters away. Jesus, you know how I hate the sound of nail clippers. Except I'm shooting 70%+. The little fragments of clipping, it's uncanny. I keep wanting to go out in the hall and get somebody in here to see it. But I don't want to break the spell. The fragile magic spell feel of those intervals where it feels you just can't miss. It's definitely one of those can't-miss intervals. It's just like that magical feeling on those rare days out there playing out of your head, DeLint calls it. Loach calls it the zone. Being in the zone. Those days when you feel perfectly calibrated. Coordinated as God. Some groove in the shape of the air of the day guides everything down and in. When you feel like you couldn't miss if you tried to. I'm so far away, the wastebasket's mouth looks more like a slot than a circle, and yet, in they go, ka-ching, ka-ching. There went another one. Even the misses are near misses. Karam's off the rim. I'm sitting here with the leg in a whirlpool in the bathroom of a Norwegian deep-tissue therapist's ranch-style house, 1,100 meters up in the Superstition Mountains. Mesa Scottsdale in flames far below. The bathroom's redwood-paneled and overlooks a precipice. The sunlight's the color of the bronze. But you never know when the magic will descend on you. You never know when the grooves will open up. And once the magic descends, you don't want to change even the smallest detail. You don't know what concordance of factors and variables yields that calibrated can't-miss feeling. And you don't want to soil the magic by trying to figure it out, but you don't want to change your grip, your stick, your side of the court, your angle of incidence to the sun. Your heart's in your throat every time you change sides of the court. You start to get like a superstitious native. What's the word? Propitiate, the divine spell. I suddenly understand the Gesundheit impulse. The salt over the shoulder and apotropaic barn signs. I'm actually frightened to switch feet now. I'm clipping off the tiniest aerodynamically viable clippings possible to prolong the time on this foot, in case the magic's a function of the foot. This isn't even the good foot. These can't-miss intervals make superstitious natives out of all of us, Hallie. The professional football players may be the worst superstitious native of all the sports. That's why all the high-tech padding and garish lycra and complex play terminology. The, like, self-reassuring display of high-tech. Because the bug-eyed natives lurking just under the surface, we know. The bug-eyed, spear-rattling, grass-skirted primitive, feeding virgins to Popocatépetl and afraid of planes. The new discursive OED says the Ots of Vancouver used to cut virgins' throats and pour the blood very carefully into the orifices of the embalmed bodies of their ancestors. I can hear those clippers. Quit with the clippers a second. The phone's no longer wedged under my jaw. Ah, I can even do it one-handed, holding the phone in one hand, but it's still the same foot. You don't know from true bug-eyed athletic superstition till you hit the pro ranks, Hallie. When you hit the show is when you'll understand primitive. Winning streaks bring the native bubbling up to the surface. Jock straps unwashed game after game until they stand up by themselves in the overhead luggage compartments of planes. Bizarrely ritualized dressing, eating, peeing. Micturation. Picture a 200-kilo interior lineman insisting on sitting down to pee. Don't even ask what wives and girlfriends have to suffer during a can't-miss winning streak. I don't want to hear sexual stuff. Then there are the players who write down exactly what they say to everybody before a game. So if it's a magical can't-miss type game, they can say exactly the same things to the same people in the same exact order before the next game. Apparently the aunts tried to fill up ancestors' bodies completely with virgin blood to preserve the privacy of their own mental states. The apposite aunt dictum here being, quote, the sated ghost cannot see secret things. The discursive OED postulates that this is one of the earlier on-record prophylactics against schizophrenia. Hey, Hallie. After a burial, rural Papineau region Quebecers purportedly drill a small hole down from the ground level all the way down through the lid of the coffin to let out the soul if it wants out. Hey, Hallie, I think I'm being followed. This is a big moment. I've totally exhausted the left foot, finally, and I'm switching to the right foot. This'll be the real test of the fragility of the spell. I said I think I'm being followed. Some men are born to lead, oh? I'm serious, and here's the weird part. Here's the part that explains why you're sharing this with your estranged little brother instead of with anybody whose credulity you'd actually value. The weird part is, I think I'm being followed by handicapped people. 2 for 3 on the right foot, with 1 carom. Jury's still out. Quit the clipping a second. I'm not kidding. Take the other day, I strike up a conversation with a certain subject in line in the post office. I notice a guy in a wheelchair behind us. No big deal. Are you listening? What are you doing going to the post office? You hate snail mail. And you quit mailing the moms the pseudo-form replies 2 years ago, Mario says. But so the conversation goes well and hits it off. Seduction strategies 12 and 16 are employed, which I'll tell you about sometime at length. The point is, the subject and I walk out together hitting it off, and there's another guy in a wheelchair, whittling in the shade of a shop awning just down the street. Okay. Still, not necessarily any kind of deal. But now the subject and I drive to her trailer park. Phoenix has trailer parks? Not those silverish metal trailers. So, but we get out of the car and across the park's lot. Here's yet another wheelchaired guy trying to maneuver in the gravel and not making a very good job of it. Doesn't Arizona have more than its share of the old and infirm? But none of these handicapped guys were old. They were all awfully burly for guys in wheelchairs. And 3 in an hour's kind of stretching it, I was thinking. I always picture you having your little trysts in more domestic suburban settings, or else tall motels with exotically shaped beds. Do women in metal trailers even have small children? This one had very sweet little twin girls who played very quietly with blocks without supervision the whole time. Huh. Cockle warming, oh. So the point is, I decamp the trailer, like, X number of hours later, and the guy's still there, mired in gravel, and in the distance, I could swear, he's got on some kind of domino mask. And now everywhere I go the last several days, there seems to be a statistically improbable number of wheelchaired figures around, lurking, somehow just a little too nonchalantly. very shy fans, possibly? Some club of leg-dysfunctional people all obsessed in that shy fan-like way with one of the first North American sports figures people think of in connection with the word leg? It's probably my imagination. A dead bird fell in my jacuzzi. But now let me ask you a couple questions. This all wasn't even why I originally called. But you brought up trailer parks and trailers. I need to confirm some suspicions. 2 points! Yeah, right in there, ka-ching! Never having been in a trailer, and even the discursive OED having pretty much of a lacuna where trailer park trailers are concerned. And this is the one supposedly non-BATS family member I call. This is who I reach out to. It'd be whom, I think. But this trailer, this lady you met's trailer, confirm or deny the following. Its carpet was wall-to-wall and extremely thin, a kind of burnt yellow or orange. Yes. The living room or like den area contained some or all of the following. A black velvet painting featuring an animal. A videophonic diorama on some sort of knick-knack shelf. A needlepoint sampler with some kind of frothy biblical saw on it. At least one piece of chintz furniture with protective doilies on the arms. A smoke-begone air filtration ashtray. The last couple of years' Reader's Digests neatly displayed in their own special inclined magazine rack. Check on velvet painting of leopard. Sampler sofa with doilies. Ashtray. No Reader's Digests. But this isn't especially funny, Hallie. The moms comes out in you in these odd little ways sometimes. The last one. The trailer person's name. Jean. May. Nora. Vera. Nora Jean or Vera May. That was my question. I guess I'll have to get back to you on that. Boy, you really put the small R in romance, don't you? But why I'm calling, it's not clear whether the fragile Cantonist magic's still in force on the right foot. I'm 7 for 9, but there's a whole different feel of somehow deliberately trying to get them in. Hallie! I've got somebody from Moment Fucking Magazine out here doing a, quote, soft profile. You've got, what? A human interest thing, on me as a human. Moment doesn't do hard sports, this lady says. They're more people-oriented, human interest. It's for something called, quote, people right now, a section. Moment's a supermarket checkout lane display magazine. It's in there with the Rodneys and gum. Lateral Alice Moore reads it. It's all over CT's waiting room. They did a thing on the little blind Illinois kid Thorpe thought so well of. Al, I think Lateral Alice spends a lot of time in grocery store checkout lanes, which, if you think about it, are almost the ideal environment for her. Al, being that she can just locomote sideways right on through. Hallie! This physically imposing Moment girl's asking all these soft, profile-esque family background questions. She wants to know about himself? Everybody! You? The mad stork? The moms? It's gradually emerging it's going to be some sort of memorial to the stork as patriarch, everybody's talents and accomplishments profiled as some sort of refracted tribute to El Storco's careers. He always did cast a long shadow, you said. Of course, and my first thought is to invite her to go piss up a string. But Moment's been in touch with the team. The front office has indicated a soft profile would be positive for the team. Cardinal Stadium isn't exactly groaning under the weight of all the fannies, winning streak or no. I've also thought of referring her to Bain. Let Bain rant at her, or send her letters. Just trying to unparse for quotes would take her a month. Her as in female. Not your typical Oren-type subject. A hardened, fast-lane, gum-cracking, maybe even small, childless journalist-type female. In from New York, on the red eye. Plus, you said imposing. Not all that tough or hard, but physically imposing. Large, but not unerotic. A girl and a half, in all directions. A girl to dominate the space of any trailer she lives in. Enough with the trailerisms. The strained quality is me trying to speak and pick caromed toenail pairings up off the floor at the same time. This girl's immune to most of your standard conversational distractions. You're afraid you're losing your touch? An immune girl and a half? I said distraction, not seduction. You kind of wisely avoid any female who you suspect could beat you up if things came down to that. She's more imposing than like most of our starting backfield, but weirdly sexy. The linemen are gaga. The tackles keep making all these cracks about does she maybe want to see their hard profile. Let's hope her prose is better than whoever did the human interest thing on the blind kid last spring. Have you bounced this new fear of the handicapped off her? Listen, you of all people should know I have zero intent of forthrightly answering any stained family linen type questions from anybody, much less somebody who takes shorthand, physical charms or no. You in tennis, you in the Saints, himself in tennis, the moms and Quebec and Royal Victoria, the moms and immigration, himself and annulation, himself and Lyle, himself and distilled spirits, himself killing himself, you and Joelle, himself and Joelle, the moms and CT, you versus the moms, ETA, non-existent films, etc. But you can see how it's all going to get me thinking. How to avoid being forthright about the stork material unless I know what the really forthright answers would be. Everybody said you'd regret not coming to the funeral, but I don't think this is what they meant. For example, the stork took himself down before CT moved in upstairs at the headmaster's house, or after. This is you asking me? Don't make this appalling for me, Hal. I wouldn't dream of even trying. Immediately before, 2-3 days before, CT had had what's now Delint's room, next to Stitz, in ComEd. And Dad knew they were very close? I don't know, O. You don't know? Mario might know. Like to chew the fat with Boo-Boo on this, O? Don't make this like this, Hallie. And Dad? The mad stork put his head in the oven. The microwave, oh. The rotisserie microwave over next to the fridge. On the freezer side, on the counter, under the cabinet, with the plates and bowls to the left of the fridge as you face the fridge. A microwave oven. That is a Raj and Wilk, oh. Nobody ever said a microwave. I think it came out generally at the funeral. I keep getting your point, if you're wondering. So, where was he found, then? 20 for 28 is what, 65%? It's not like this is all that... The microwave was in the kitchen. I already explained, oh. All right. All right. So, okay, now. Who would you say speaks most about the guy? Keeps his memory alive, verbally. The most now. You, CT, or the moms? I think it's a three-way tie. So it's never mentioned. Nobody talks about him. It's taboo. But you seem to be forgetting somebody. Mario talks about him. About it. Sometimes. To what and or who all this talking? To me, for one, I suppose. And so you do talk about it, but only to him, and only after he initiates it. Oren... I lied. I haven't even started on the right foot yet. I've been too afraid to change my angle of approach to the nails. The right foot's a whole different angle of approach. I'm afraid the magic is left foot dependent. I'm like your superstitious lineman. Talking about it's broken the spell. Now I'm self-conscious and afraid. I've been sitting here on the edge of the bed with my right knee up under my chin, poised, studying the foot, frozen with aboriginal terror, and lying about it to my own brother. Can I ask you who it was who found him? Who found him at the oven? Found by one Harold James Incandenza, 13, going on really old. You were who found him? Not the moms? Listen, may I ask why this sudden interest after 4 years, 216 days, and with 2 years of that not even once even calling? I've already said I don't feel safe not answering Helen's questions if I haven't got a handle on what I'm not saying. Helen, so you did, is why. I'm still frozen, by the way. The self-consciousness that kills the magic is getting worse and worse. This is why Pemulus and Trolch always seem to let a lead slip away. The standard term is tightening up. The clippers are poised, blades on either side of the nail. I just can't achieve the unconsciousness to actually clip. Maybe it was cleaning up the few that missed. Suddenly the wastebasket seems small and far away. I've lost the magic by talking about it instead of just giving into it. Launching the nail out toward the wastebasket now seems like an exercise in telemetry.
You mean telemetry?
How embarrassing. When the skills go, they go.
Listen.
You know, why don't you go ahead and ask me whatever standard ghoulish questions you want not to answer? This may be your only shot. Usually I seem not to talk about it.
Was she there? The PGOAT?
Joelle hadn't been around the grounds since you two split up. You know about that. Himself met her at the brownstone shooting. I'm sure you know way more about whatever it was they were trying to make. Joelle and himself. Himself went underground, too. CT was already doing most of the day-to-day administration. Himself was down in that little post-production closet off the lab for like a solid month. Mario'd bring food and essentials down. Sometimes he'd eat with Lyle.
I don't think he came up to ground level for at least a month, except for just one trip out to Belmont to McLean's for a 2-day purge and detox.
This was about a week after he came back. He'd flown off somewhere for 3 days. For what the impression I get was work-related business. Film-related. If Lyle didn't go with him, Lyle went somewhere, because he wasn't in the weight room. I know Mario didn't go with him and didn't know what was up. Mario doesn't lie.
It was unclear whether he'd finished whatever he was editing. Himself, I mean. He stopped living on April 1st, if you weren't sure, was the day.
I can tell you on April 1st he wasn't back by the time PM matches started, because I'd been around the lab door right after lunch and he wasn't back.
He went in for another detox, you say. In what, March?
The moms herself emerged and risked exterior transit and took him herself, so I gather it was urgent.
He quit drinking in January, Hal. It was something Joelle was real specific about. She called even after we'd agreed not to call and told me about it, even after I said I didn't want to hear about him if she was going to still be in his things. She said he hadn't had a drop in weeks. It was her condition for letting him put her in what he was doing. She said he said he'd do anything.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. By this time, it was hard to tell whether he'd been ingesting anything or not. Apparently, at a certain point, it stops making a difference.
Did he have film-related things with him when he flew somewhere? A film case? Equipment?
Oh, I didn't see him leave, and I didn't see him come back. He wasn't around by match time, I know. Freer beat me badly and fast. It was 4-1, 4-2, something, and we were the first ones done. I came around the headmaster's house to do an emergency load of laundry before dinner. This was around 16:30. I came over and came in and noticed something right away.
And found him.
And went to get the moms. Then changed my mind and went to get CT. Then changed my mind and went to get Lyle. But the first authority figure I ran into was Shtit. He was irreproachably brisk and efficient and sensible about everything and turned out to be just the authority figure to go get in the first place.
I didn't even think a microwave oven would go on unless the door was closed. What with microwaves oscillating all over inside them.
I thought there was like a refrigerator light or a read-only tab-like device. You seem to be forgetting the technical ingenuity of the person we're talking about.
And you were totally shocked and traumatized. And he was asphyxiated, irradiated, and or burnt.
As we later reconstructed the scene, he'd used a wide-bit drill and small hacksaw to make a head-sized hole in the oven door.
Then when he'd gotten his head in, he'd carefully packed the extra space around his neck with wadded-up aluminum foil.
Sounds kind of ad hoc and jerry-rigged and haphazard.
Everybody's a critic. This wasn't an aesthetic endeavor. And there was a large and half-full bottle of wild turkey found on the counter not far away, with a large red decorative gift wrappish bow on the neck.
On the bottle's neck, you mean?
That is a Raj.
As in he hadn't been sober after all.
That would seem to follow, O.
And he left no note or living will-type video or communique of any kind.
Oh, I know you know very well he didn't. You're not asking me stuff I know you know, besides criticizing him and making sobriety claims when you weren't anywhere near the scene or the funeral. Are we just about through here? I've got a whole long-nailed foot waiting for me here.
As you reconstructed the scene, you just said.
Also, it just hit me. I've got a library book I was supposed to return. I'd forgotten all about it. Kertwang.
Reconstructed the scene as in the scene when you found him was somehow deconstructed?
You of all people, O. You know that was the one word he hated more than...
So burned, then.
Just say it.
He was really, really badly burned.
No, wait, asphyxiated. The packed foil was to preserve the vacuum in a space that got automatically evacuated as soon as the magnetron started oscillating and generating the microwaves.
Magnetron?
What do you know about magnetrons and oscillators? Aren't you the brother of mine who has to be reminded which way to turn the ignition key in a car?
Brief liaison with this one subject who used to model at kitchen appliance trade shows. It was kind of a brutal brand of modeling. She'd stand there on a huge rotating Lazy Susan in a one-piece, with one thigh turned in and a hand out palm up, indicating the appliance next to her. Stood there smiling and spinning day after day. She'd stagger around half the evening trying to get her balance back.
Did this subject by any chance explain to you how microwaves actually cook things? Or have you, for example, say... Ever baked a potato in a microwave oven? Did you know you have to cut the potato open before you turn the oven on? Do you know why that is?
Jesus.
The BPD field pathologist said the buildup of internal pressures would have been almost instantaneous, and equivalent in kilograms per square centimeter to over 2 sticks of TNT.
83.
Jesus Christ, Allie.
Hence the need to reconstruct the scene.
Jesus.
Don't feel bad. There's no guarantee anybody would have told you, even if you'd popped in for, say, the memorial service. I, for one, wasn't exactly a jabberjaw at the time. I seem to have been evincing shock and trauma throughout the whole funeral period. What I mostly recall is a great deal of quiet talk about my psychic well-being. It got so I kind of enjoyed popping in and out of rooms just to enjoy the quiet conversation stopping amid clause.
You must have been traumatized beyond fucking belief.
Your concern is much appreciated. Believe me. Trauma seems to have been the consensus. It turns out Rusk and the moms had begun interviewing top-flight trauma and grief counselors for me within hours after it happened. I was shunted directly into concentrated grief and trauma therapy. 4 days a week for over a month, right in the April-May gearing up for summer tour period. I lost 2 spots on the 14s ladder just because of all the PM matches I missed. I missed the hard-court qualies and would have missed Indianapolis if I hadn't finally figured out the grief and trauma therapy process.
But it helped, ultimately, the grief therapy.
The therapy ended up taking place in that professional building right up Com Ave, past the Sunstrand Plaza by Lake Street, the one with bricks the color of Thousand Island dressing we all run by 4 days a week. Who was to know one of the continent's top grief men was right up the street?
The moms didn't want the process going on too far from the old web, if need be, I'm sure.
This grief counselor insisted I call him by his first name, which I forget. A large red meaty character with eyebrows at a demonic-looking synclinal angle, and very small, nubbly gray teeth. And a mustache. He always had the remains of a sneeze in his mustache. I got to know that mustache very well. His face had that same blood pressure flush CT's face gets. And let's not even go into the man's hands. The mom said Rusk shunt you to a top grief pro so she wouldn't have to feel guilty about practically sawing the hole in the microwave door herself. Among other little guilt and anti-guilt operations. She always did believe himself was doing more with Joel than work. Poor old himself never had eyes for anybody but the moms. This was one tough hombre, oh, this grief counselor. He made a Rusk session look like a day on the Adriatic. He wouldn't let up. How did it feel? How does it feel? How do you feel when I ask how it feels? Rusk always reminded me of a freshman fumbling for some subject's bra, the way she'd sort of tug and fumble at your head. The man was unsatisfiable and scary. Those eyebrows, that ham-rind face, bland little eyes, he never once turned his face away or looked away at anything but right at me. It was the most brutal 6 weeks of full-bore professional conversation anybody could imagine. With fucking CT already moving his collection of platform shoes and unconvincing hairpieces and Stairmaster in upstairs at the headmaster's house already. The whole thing was nightmarish. I just could not figure out what the guy wanted. I went down and chewed through the Copley Square Library's grief section. Not disc, the actual books. I read Kubler-Ross, Hinton. I slogged through Kastenbaum and Kastenbaum. I read things like Elizabeth Harper Neal's Seven Choices, Taking the Steps to New Life After Losing Someone You Love, which was 352 pages of sheer goo.
84.
I went in and presented with textbook perfect symptoms of denial, bargaining, anger, still more denial, depression. I listed my seven textbook choices and vacillated plausibly between and among them. I provided etymological data on the word acceptance all the way back to Wycliffe and 14th century Languedoc French. The grief therapist was having none of it. It was like one of those final exams in nightmares where you prepare immaculately, and then you get there and all the exam questions are in Hindi. I even tried telling him himself was miserable and pancreatitic, and out of his tree half the time by then anyway, that he and the moms were basically estranged, that even work and Wild Turkey weren't helping anymore, that he was despondent about something he was editing that turned out so bad he didn't want it released, that what happened was probably kind of a mercy in the end.
Himself didn't suffer then in the microwave.
The BPD field pathologist who drew the chalk lines around himself's shoes on the floor said maybe 10 seconds tops. He said the pressure buildup would have been almost instantaneous. Then he gestured at the kitchen walls. Then he threw up. The field pathologist.
Jesus Christ, Hallie.
But the grief therapist was having none of it. The at least his suffering's over angle that Kastenbaum and Kastenbaum said is basically a neon bright sign of real acceptance. This grief therapist hung on like a Gila monster. I even tried telling him I really didn't feel anything.
Which was a fiction.
Of course it was a fiction. What could I do? I was panic-stricken. This guy was a nightmare. His face just hung there over his desk like a hypertensive moon, never turning away. With his glistening mucoidal dew in his mustache. And don't even ask me about his hands. He was my worst nightmare. Talk about self-consciousness and fear. He was a top-rank authority figure, and I was failing to supply what he wanted. He made it manifestly clear I wasn't delivering the goods. I never failed to deliver the goods before.
You were our designated deliverer, Hallie. No question about it.
But here was this authority figure with top credentials in frames over every square centimeter of his walls, who sat there and refused even to define what the goods here would be. Say what you will about Stitt and DeLint, they let you know what they want in no uncertain terms. Flotman, Chawaf, Prickett, Nwangi, Fentress, Lingley, Pettyjohn, Ogilvy, Leith, even the moms in her way. They tell you on the very first day of class what they want from you. But this son of a bee right here, no dice.
You must have been in shock the whole time, too.
Oh, it got worse and worse. I dropped weight, I couldn't sleep. This was when the nightmares started. I kept dreaming of a face in the floor. I lost to Freer again, then to Coil. I went 3 sets with Trolch. I got B's on 2 different quizzes. I couldn't concentrate on anything else. I'd become obsessed with the fear that I was somehow going to flunk grief therapy. That this professional was going to tell Rusk and Shtit and CT and the moms that I couldn't deliver the goods.
I'm sorry I couldn't be there.
The odd thing was that the more obsessed I got, the worse I played and slept, the happier everybody got. The grief therapist complimented me on how haggard I was looking. Rusk told Delint, the grief therapist had told the moms, that it was starting to work, that I was starting to grieve, but that it was a long process.
Long and costly.
Roger, I began to despair. I began to foresee somehow getting left back in grief therapy, never delivering the goods, and it never ending. Having these Kafkaesque interfaces with this man day after day, week after week. It was now May. The continental clays I'd gotten all the way to the 4th round of the year before were coming up, and it became quietly clear that everybody felt I was at a crucial stage in the long, costly, grieving process, and I wasn't going to get to go with the contingent to Indianapolis unless I could figure out some last-ditch way to deliver the emotional goods to this guy. I was totally desperate, a wreck.
So you schlepped on down to the weight room. You and the forehead paid a visit to good old Lyle.
Lyle turned out to be the key. He was down there reading Leaves of Grass. He was going through a Whitman period, part of grieving for himself, he said. I'd never gone to Lyle before in any kind of supplicatory capacity. But he said he took one grief-stricken look at me, flailing away down there, working up a gourmet sweat, and said he felt so moved by my additional suffering on top of having had to be the first of himself's loved ones to experience the loss of himself, that he'd bent every cerebral effort. I assumed the position and let him at the old forehead and explained what had been happening and that if I couldn't figure out some way to satisfy this grief pro, I was going to end up in a soft, quiet room somewhere. Lyle's key insight was that I'd been approaching the issue from the wrong side. I'd gone to the library and acted like a student of grief. What I needed to chew through was the section for grief professionals themselves. I needed to prepare from the grief pro's own perspective. How could I know what a professional wanted unless I knew what he was professionally required to want, etc.? It was simple, he said. I needed to empathize with the grief therapist, Lyle said, if I wanted to spread a broader breast than his own. It was such a simple observation of my normal goods delivery preparation system that it hadn't once occurred to me, Lyle explained.
Lyle said all that? That doesn't sound like Lyle.
But a sort of soft light broke inside me for the first time in weeks. I called a cab, still in my towel. I jumped in the cab before it had even stopped at the gate. I actually said, the nearest library with a cutting-edge professional grief and trauma therapy section and step on it, etc., etc.
The Lyle my class knew wasn't a how-to-deliver-the-goods-to-authorities type figure.
By the time I hit the grief therapists the next day, I was a different man, immaculately prepared, unfazable. Everything I'd come to dread about the man, the eyebrows, the multicultural music in the waiting room, the implacable stare, the crusty mustache, the little gray teeth, even the hands. Did I mention that this grief therapist hid his hands under his desk at all times?
But you got through it. You grieved to everybody's satisfaction, you're saying.
What I did, I went in there and presented with anger at the grief therapist. I accused the grief therapist of actually inhibiting my attempt to process my grief by refusing to validate my absence of feelings. I told him the truth already. I used foul language and slang. I said I didn't give a damn if he was an abundantly credentialed authority figure or not. I called him a shithead. I asked him what the cock-shitting fuck he wanted from me. My overall demeanor was paroxysmic. I'd told him that I didn't feel anything, which was the truth. I said it seemed like he wanted me to feel toxically guilty for not feeling anything. Notice I was subtly inserting certain loaded professional grief therapy terms like validate, process as a transitive verb, and toxic guilt. These were library-derived. The whole difference was this time you were walking on court oriented, with a sense of where the lines were, Stitt would say.
The grief therapist encouraged me to go with my paroxysmic feelings, to name and honor my rage. He got more and more pleased and excited as I angrily told him I flat out refused to feel iota one of guilt of any kind. I said, what? I was supposed to have lost even more quickly to free her, so I could have come around the headmaster's house in time to stop himself? It wasn't my fault, I said. It was not my fault I found him, I shouted. I was down to black street socks. I had legitimate emergency-grade laundry to do. By this time I was pounding myself on the breastbone with rage as I said that it just, by God, was not my fault that...
That what?
That's just what the grief therapist said.
The professional literature had a whole bold font section on abrupt pauses in high affect speech.
The grief therapist was now leaning way forward at the waist. His lips were wet. I was in the zone, therapeutically speaking.
I felt on top of things for the first time in a long time. I broke eye contact with him.
That... I'd been hungry, I muttered.
Come again?
That's just what he said, the grief therapist. I muttered that it was nothing. Just that it damn sure wasn't my fault that I had the reaction I did when I came through the front door of the headmaster's house before I came into the kitchen to get to the basement stairs and found himself with his head in what was left of the microwave. When I first came in and was still in the foyer trying to get my shoes off without putting the dirty laundry bag down on the white carpet and hobbing around and couldn't be expected to have any idea what had happened, I said nobody can choose or have any control over their first unconscious thoughts or reactions when they come into a house. I said it wasn't my fault that my first unconscious thought turned out to be...
Jesus, kid, what?
That something smelled delicious, I screamed. The force of my shriek almost sent the grief therapist over backwards in his leather chair. A couple credentials fell off the wall. I bent over in my non-leather chair as if for a crash landing. I put a hand to each temple and rocked back and forth in the chair, weeping. It came out between sobs and screams. That had been 4 hours plus since lunchtime, and I'd worked hard and played hard, and I was starved. That the saliva had started the minute I came through the door. That, golly, something smells delicious, was my first reaction.
But you forgave yourself.
I absolved myself with 7 minutes left in the session, right there, in full, approving view of the grief therapist.
He was ecstatic. By the end, I swear, his side of the desk was half a meter off the floor, and my grief therapist textbook breakdown into genuine affect and trauma and guilt, and textbook ear-splitting grief, then absolution.
Christ on a jet ski, Hallie.
But you got through it. You really did grieve. And you can tell me what it was like so I can say something generic but convincing about loss and grief for Helen for a moment.
But I'd admitted that somehow the single most nightmarishly compelling thing about this top grief therapist was that his hands were never visible. The dreadfulness of the whole 6 weeks somehow coalesced around the issue of the guy's hands. His hands never emerged from underneath his desk. It was as if his arms terminated at the elbow. Besides mustache material analysis, I also spent large blocks of each hour trying to imagine the configurations and activities of those hands under there.
Hallie, let me just ask, and then I'll never bring it back up again. You implied before that what was especially traumatic was that himself's head had popped like an uncut spud.
Then on what turned out to be the last day of the therapy, the last day before the A-squads were picked for Indianapolis, after I'd finally delivered the goods and my traumatic grief was professionally pronounced uncovered and countenanced and processed, when I put on my sweatshirt and got set to take my leave and came up to the desk and put out my hand in a trembly, grateful way he couldn't possibly have refused, and he stood and brought out the hand and shook my hand, I finally understood.
His hands were disfigured or something.
His hands were no bigger than a 4-year-old girl's. It was surreal. This massive, authoritative figure, with a huge red meaty face and thick walrus mustache and dewlaps and a neck that spilled over the rim of his shirt collar, and his hands were tiny and pink and hairless and butt soft, delicate as shells. The hands were the capper. I barely made it out of the office before it started.
The cathartic, post-traumatic-like re-experience hysteria. You reeled out of there.
I barely made it to the men's room down the hall. I was laughing so hysterically I was afraid all the periodontists and CPAs on either side of the men's room would hear. I sat in a stall with my hands over my mouth, stamping my feet and beating my head against first one side of the stall and then the other in hysterical mirth. If you could have seen those hands!
But you got through it all. And you can thumbnail sketch the overall feeling for me.
What I feel is myself gathering my resources for the right foot, finally. That magic feeling's back. I'm not lining up the vectors for the wastebasket or anything. I'm not even thinking. I'm trusting the feeling. It's like that celluloid moment when Luke removes his high-tech targeting helmet.
What helmet?
You know, of course, that human nails are the vestiges of talons and horns. That they're atavistic, like coccyges and hair. That they develop in utero long before the cerebral cortex.
What's the matter?
That at some point in the first trimester we lose our gills but are now little more than a bladdery sack of spinal fluid and a rudimentary tail and hair follicles and little microchips of vestigial talon and horn.
Is this to make me feel bad? Did this fuck you up, me probing for details after all this time? Did it reactivate the grief?
Just one more confirmation. The trailer's interior. There was some object, or contiguous trio of objects, with the following color scheme. Brown, lavender, and either mint green or jonquil yellow.
I can call back when you're more yourself. The lake's starting to prune a bit from the whirlpool anyway.
I'll be right here. I've got a whole foot to yield to the magic with. I'm not going to alter the smallest particular. I'm just about ready to bear down on the clippers. It's going to feel right, I know.
A throw. Like an Afghan throw on the chintz sofa. The yellow was more fluorescent than jonquil.
And the word is asphyxiated. Kick some egg-shaped balls for all of us, oh. The next sound you hear will be unpleasant, Hal said, holding the phone down right next to the foot. His expression, terrifically intense. The 6th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. White halogen off the green of the composite surface, the light out on the indoor courts at the Port Washington Tennis Academy is the color of sour apples. To the spectators at the gallery's glass, the duos of players arrayed and moving down below have a reptilian tinge to their skin, a kind of seasick-type pallor. This annual meet is mammoth. Both academies, A and B teams, for both boys and girls, both singles and doubles, in 14 and unders, 16 and unders, 18 and unders. 36 courts stretch out down away from one end's gallery under a fancy tri-dome system of permanent all-weather lung. A junior tennis team has 6 people on it, with the highest ranked playing number 1 singles against the other team's best guy, the next highest ranked playing number 2, and on down the line to number 6. After the 6 singles matches, there are 3 doubles, with the team's best 2 singles players usually turning around and also playing number 1 doubles, with occasional exceptions, for example, the Vaught twins, or the fact that Schacht and Trolch, way down on the B-squad in the 18s singles, play number 2 doubles on ETA's 18s A-team, because they've been a doubles team since they were incontinent toddlers back in Philly, and they're so experienced and smooth together they can wipe surfaces with the 18s A-team's number 3 and number 4 singles guys, Coyle and Axford, who prefer to skip doubles altogether. It all tends to get complicated and probably not all that interesting. Unless you play. But so a normal meet between 2 junior teams
is the best out of 9 matches, whereas this mammoth annual early November thing between ETA and PWTA will try to be the best out of 108. A 54-match all-conclusion is extremely unlikely, odds being 1 in 2 to the 27th power, and has never happened in 9 years. The meet's always down on Long Island because PWTA has indoor courts out the bazoo. Each year, the academy that loses the meet has to get up on tables at the buffet supper afterward and sing a really silly song. An even more embarrassing transaction is supposed to take place in private between the 2 schools' headmasters, but nobody knows quite what. Last year, Enfield lost 57-51, and Charles Tavis didn't say one word on the bus ride home and used the lavatory several times. But last year, ETA didn't have John Wayne. And last year, H.J. Incandenza hadn't yet exploded competitively. John Wayne, formerly of Montsurf, Quebec, an asbestos mining town 10 clicks or so from the infamously rupture-prone Mercier Dam, formerly the top-ranked junior male in Canada at 16, as well as number 5 overall in the Organization of North American Nations Tennis Association computerized rankings, was finally, successfully recruited by Gerhard Schmidt and Aubrey DeLint last spring via the argument that 2 gratis years at an American academy would maybe let Wayne bypass the usual couple seasons of top college tennis and go pro immediately at 19 with more than enough competitive tempering. This reasoning was not unsound, since the top 4 U.S. Tennis Academy's tournament schedules closely resemble the ATP Tour in terms of numbing travel and continual stress. John Wayne is currently ranked number 3 in the ONANTA's Boys 18s and number 2 in the USTA. Canada, under provincial pressure, has disowned him as an immigrant, and has, in this year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, reached the semis of both the Junior French and Junior U.S. Opens, and has lost to exactly nobody American in 7 meets and a dozen major tournaments. He trails the number 1 American kid, an independent down in Florida, Veach, by only a couple USTA computer points, and they haven't yet met in sanctioned play this year. And the kid is well known to be hiding out from Wayne, avoiding him, staying down in Pompano Beach, allegedly nursing a, 4-month groin pull sitting on his ranking.
85.
He's supposed to show at the Whataburger Invitational in Arizona in a couple weeks, this Veach, having won the 18s at age 17 there last year. But he's got to know Wayne's coming down, and speculation is rife and complex. ONANTA-wise, there's an Argentine kid that Mexico's Academia de Veracruz has got rattled away who's number 1, but not about to lose to anybody, having this year taken 3 out of 4 legs of the Junior Grand Slam, the first time anybody's done that since a sepulchral Czech kid named Lendl, who retired from the show and suicided well before the advent of subsidized time. But so there's Wayne at number 1. And it's been established that Hal Incandenza, last year a respectable but by no means to write home about 43rd nationally, and bouncing between number 4 and number 5 on the Academy's A team in boys' 16s singles, has made a kind of quantumish competitive plateaus hop such that this year, the one nearly done, Kimberly Clark Corporation's Depend Absorbent Products Division, soon to give way to the highest corporate bidder for rights to the new year, Incandenza, mind you, this year just 17, is 4th in the nation and number 6 on the ONANTA computer and playing A number 2 for ETA in boys' 18s. These competitive explosions happen sometimes. Nobody at the academy talks to Hal much about the explosion, sort of the way you avoid a pitcher who's got a no-hitter going. Hal's delicate and spinny, rather cerebral game hasn't altered, but this year it seems to have grown a beak. No longer fragile or abstracted-looking on court, he seems now almost to hit the corners without thinking about it, His unforced error stats look like a decimal error. Hal's game involves attrition. He'll probe, pecking, until some angle opens up. Until then, he'll probe. He'd rather run his man ragged, wear him down. Three different opponents this past summer had to go to oxygen during breaks.
86.
His serve yanks across at people as if on a hidden diagonal string. His serve now, suddenly, after four summers, of thousand-a-day serves to no one at dawn, is suddenly supposed to be one of the best left-handed kick serves the junior circuit has ever seen. Schtick calls Hal in Condensa his revenant now, and sometimes points his pointer at him in an affectionate way from his observation crow's nest in the transom during drills. Most of the singles A matches are underway. Coyle and his man on three are in an endless, butterfly-shaped rally. Hal's muscular but unquick opponent is bent over trying to get his breath, while Hal stands there and futzes with his strings. Tall Paul Shaw, on six, bounces the ball eight times before he serves. Never seven or nine. And John Wayne's, without question, the best male player to appear at Enfield Academy in several years. He'd been spotted first by the late Dr. James Incandenza at age six, 11 summers back, when Incandenza was doing an early and coldly conceptual Super 8 on people named John Wayne, who were not the real thespio-historical John Wayne. A film Wayne's not-to-be-fucked-with Papa eventually litigated the kid's segment out of because the film had the word homo in the title.
87.
On one, with John Wayne up at net, Port Washington's best boy throws up a lob. It's a beauty. The ball soars slowly up, just skirts the indoor court's system of beams and lamps, and floats back down gentle as lint. A lovely quad function of fluorescent green seems whirling. John Wayne backpedals and flies back after it. You can tell, if you play seriously, you can tell just by the way the ball comes off a guy's strings whether the lob is going to land fair. There's surprisingly little thought. Coaches tell serious players what to do so often, it gets automatic. John Wayne's game could be described as having a kind of automatic beauty. When the lob first went up, he'd backpedaled from the net, keeping the ball in sight until it reached the top of its flight and its curve broke, casting many shadows in the tray of lights hung from the ceiling's insulation. Then, Wayne turned his back to the ball and sprinted flat out for the spot where it will land fair. Would land. He doesn't have to locate the ball again until it's hit the green court just inside the baseline. By now he's come around the side of the bounced ball's flight, still sprinting. He looks mean in a kind of distant way. He comes around the side of the bounced ball's second ascent, the way you come up around the side of somebody you're going to hurt. And he has to leave his feet and half pirouette to get his side to the ball and whip his big right arm through it, catching it on the rise and slapping it down the line past the Port Washington boy, who's played the percentages and followed a beauty of a lob up to net. The Port Washington kid applauds with the heel of his hand against his strings, in acknowledgement of a really nice get, even as he looks up at Port Washington's coaching staff in the gallery. The spectator's glass panel is at ground level, and the players play below it on courts that have been carved out of a kind of pit dug long ago. Some Northeast clubs favor courts below ground because earth insulates and keeps utility bills daunting instead of prohibitive once the lungs go up. The gallery panel stretches overhead behind courts 1 through 6, but there's a decided spectatorial clumping at the part of the gallery that looks out over the show courts, boys' 18s, number 1 and number 2, Wayne and Hal, and PWTA's two best. Now, after Wayne's balletic winner, there's the sad sound of a small crowd behind glasses applause. On the court, the applause is muffled and compromised by on-court sounds, and sounds like the trapped survivors of something tapping for help at a great depth. The panel is like an aquarium's glass, thick and clean, and traps noise behind it. And to the gallery it seems that 72 well-muscled children are arrayed and competing in total silence in the pit. Almost everyone in the gallery is wearing tennis clothes and bright nylon warm-ups. Some even wear wristbands, the tennis equivalent of a football fan's pennant and raccoon coat. John Wayne's post-pirouette backward inertia has carried him into the heavy black tarpaulin that hangs several meters behind both sides of the 36 courts on a system of rods and rings, not unlike a very ambitious shower curtain. The tarps hiding from view the water-stained walls of puffy white-wrapped insulation and creating a narrow passage for players to get to their courts without crossing open court and interrupting play. Wayne hits the heavy tarp and kind of bounces off, producing a boom that resounds. The sounds on court in an indoor venue are huge and complex. Everything echoes, and the echoes then meld. In the gallery, Tavis and Nwangi bite their knuckles, and Delint squashes his nose flat against the glass in anxiety as everyone else politely applauds. Stitt calmly taps his pointer against the top of his boot at times of high stress. Wayne isn't hurt, though. Everybody goes into the tarp sometimes. That's what it's there for. It always sounds worse than it is. The boom of the tarp sounds bad down below, though. The boom rattles Teddy Schacht, who's kneeling in the little passage right behind court number one, holding M. Pemulis's head, as Pemulis, down on one knee, is sick into a tall white plastic spare ball bucket. Schacht has to haul Pemulis slightly back as Wayne's outline bulges for a moment into the billowing tarp and threatens to knock Pemulis over, plus maybe the bucket, which would be a bad scene. Pemulis, deep into the little hell of his own nauseous, pre-match nerves, is too busy trying to vomit without sound to hear the mean sound of Wayne's winner or the boom of him against the heavy curtain. It's freezing back here in the little passage, up next to insulation and I-beams and away from the infrared heaters that hang over the courts. The plastic bucket is full of old, bald Wilson tennis balls and Pemulis's breakfast. There is, of course, an odor. Schock doesn't mind. He lightly strokes the sides of Pemulis's head as his mother had stroked his own big, sick head back in Philly. Placed at eye-level intervals in the tarp are little plastic windows, archer slit views of each court from the cold backstage passage. Schacht sees John Wayne walk to the net post and flip his card as he and his opponent change sides. Even indoors you change ends of the court after every odd-numbered game. No one knows why odd rather than even. Each PWTA court has, welded to its west net post, another smaller post with a double set of, like, flippable cards with big red numerals from 1 to 7. In umpless competition, you're supposed to flip your card appropriately at every change of sides to help the gallery follow the score in the set. A lot of junior players neglect to flip their cards. Wayne is always automatic and scrupulous in his accounts. Wayne's father is an asbestos miner, who at 43 is far and away the seniorest guy on his shift. He now wears triple-thick masks and is trying to hold on until John Wayne can start making serious dollars and take him away from all this. He has not seen his eldest son play since John Wayne's Quebecois and Canadian citizenships were revoked last year. Wayne's card is on 5. His opponent has yet to flip a card. Wayne never even sits down to take the 60 seconds he's allowed on each change of sides. His opponent, in his light blue, flare-collared shirt with Wilson and PWTA on the sleeves, says something not unfriendly as Wayne brushes past him by the post. Wayne doesn't respond one way or the other. He just goes back to the baseline farthest from Schacht's little tarp window and bounces a ball up and down in the air with the reticulate face of his stick as the Port Washington boy sits in his little canvas director's chair and towels the sweat off his arms, neither of which is large, and looks briefly up at the gallery behind the panel. The thing about Wayne is, he's all business. His face on court is blankly rigid, with the hypertonic masking of schizophrenics and Zen adepts. He tends to look straight ahead at all times. He is about as reserved as they come. His emotions emerge in terms of velocity, intelligence as strategic focus. His play, like his manner in general, seems to shocked, less alive than undead. Wayne tends to eat and study alone. He's sometimes seen with two or three expatriate ETA nooks, but when they're together they all seem morose. It's wholly unclear to Schacht how Wayne feels about the U.S. or his citizenship status. He figures Wayne figures it doesn't much matter. He is destined for the show. He will be an all-business entertainer, citizen of the world, everywhere undead, endorsing juice drinks and liniment ointment. Pemulus has nothing left and is spasming dryly over the bucket. His covered Dunlop gut-strung sticks and gear tumble just past Schacht's in the passage. They are the last guys to get out on court. Schacht is to play number 3 singles on the 18's B team. Pemulus, number 6 B. They are undeniably tardy getting out there. Their opponents stand out on the baselines of courts 9 and 12, waiting for them to come out and warm up, jittery, stretching out the way you do when you've already stretched out, dribbling fresh, bright balls with their Black Wilson wide-body sticks. The whole Port Washington Tennis Academy student body gets free and mandatory Wilson sticks under an administrative contract. Nothing personal, but no way would Schacht let an academy tell him what brand of stick to swing. He himself favors headmasters, which is regarded as bizarre and eccentric. The AMF head rep brings them out to him out of some cobwebby warehouse, where they're kept since the line was discontinued during the large head revolution many years back. Aluminum headmasters have small, perfectly round heads and a dull blue plastic brace in the V of the throat, and look less like weapons than toys. Coath and Axford are always kibitzing that they've seen a headmaster for sale at, like, a flea market or garage sale someplace, and Schacht, better get down there quick. Schacht, who's historically tight with Mario and with Lyle down in the weight room, where Schacht, since the knee and the Crohn's disease, likes to go even on off days to work off discomfort, and Delint and Loach are always on him about not getting muscle-bound, has a way of just smiling and holding his tongue when he's kibitzed. "Are you okay?" Pemula says, "Blurg!" He wipes at his forehead in a gesture of completion and submits to being hauled to his feet and stands there on his own with his hands on his hips, slightly bent. Schacht straightens and pulls some wrinkles out of the bandage around the brace on his knee. "Take maybe another second. Wayne's already way up." Pemulus sniffs unpleasantly. "How come this happens to me every time? This is not like me."
"Happens to some people is all."
"This hunched, spurting pale guy is not any me I ever recognize."
Schacht gathers gear.
"Some people, their nerves are in their stomachs."
"Sisney, Yardguard, Lord, you? Stomach men."
"Teddy, brother. Man, I'm never once hungover or a competitive thing. I take elaborate precautions, not so much as a whippet. I'm always in bed the night before by 2300, all pink-cheeked and clean."
As they pass the plastic window behind Court 2, Schacht sees Hal and Condensa try to pass his serve-and-volley guy with a baroque sideways slice down the backhand side and miss just wide. Hal's card's already flipped to 4. Schacht gives a little toodaloo wave that Hal can't see to acknowledge. Pemulus is in front of him as they go down the cold passage.
"Hal's way up, too. Another victory for the forces of peace."
"Ugh, Jesus, I feel awful,"
Pemulus says.
"Things could be worse."
"Expand on that, will you?"
This wasn't like that Atlanta stomach incident. We were enclosed here. No one saw. You saw that glass. The shtit and the land, it's all a silent movie down here. Nobody heard thing one. Our guys will think we were back here butting heads to get enraged or something. Or we can tell them I got a cramp. That was a freebie in terms of stomach incidents.
Pemulus is a whole different person before competitive play.
Ah, I'm fucking inept.
Shocked laughs.
You're one of the eptest people I know. Get off your own back. Never remember getting sick as a kid. Now it's like I make myself sick just from worrying about getting sick.
Well, then there you go. Just don't think anything thoracic. Pretend you don't have a stomach.
I have no stomach, Pemulus says. His head stays still when he talks, at least, negotiating the passage. He carries four sticks, a rough white PWTA locker room towel, an empty ball can full of high chlorine Long Island water, nervously zipping and unzipping the top stick's cover. Shocked only ever carries three sticks. His don't have covers on them. Except for Pemulus and Raider and Unwin, and a couple others who favor gut strings and really need protection, nobody at Enfield uses racket covers. It's like an anti-fashion statement. People with covers make a point of telling you they're valid and for gut. A similar point of careful non-pride is never having their shirts tucked in. Ortho Stice used to drill and cut off black jeans until Shtit had Tony Nwangi go over and scream at him about it. Each academy has its own style, or anti-style. The PWTA people, more or less a de facto subsidiary of Wilson, have unnecessary light blue Wilson covers on all their courtside synthetic strong sticks, and big red W's stenciled on their Wilson synth gut strings. You have to let your company of choice spray paint their logo on your strings if you want to be on their free list for sticks, is the universal junior deal. Shocked's orange Gamma 9 synthetic strings have AMF Head Inc.'s weird Taoist paraboloid logo sprayed on them. Pemulus isn't on Dunlop's free list, but gets the ETA stringer to put Dunlop's dot and circumflex trademark on all his stick's strings as a kind of touchingly insecure gesture, in Shocked's opinion.
88.
I played your guy in Tampa 2 years ago, Pemulus says, sidestepping one of the old discolored drill balls that always litter passages behind indoor tarps. Name escapes.
Le-something, says Shocked. Yet another nook. One of those names that start with Le.
Mario Incandenza, in a pair of little Aldern Talat Kelpsa's ETA drill sweats, is lurching, noiselessly, some 10 meters behind them in the passage. His police lock up and head uncamered.
He's framing Shocked's back in a three-cornered box with his thumbs and long fingers, simulating the view through a lens.
Mario's been authorized to travel with the squads to the Whataburger Invitational for final footage for his short and upbeat annual documentary. Brief testimonials and lighthearted moments and behind-the-scenes shots and emotional moments on court, etc., that every year gets distributed to ETA alumni and patrons and guests at the pre-Thanksgiving fundraising exhibition and formal fete. Mario is wondering how you could get enough light back here in the tarp tunnel to film a tense, cold, pre-match gladiatorial march behind an indoor tarp, carrying tennis rackets in your arms like an obscene bouquet, without sacrificing the dim and diffuse and kind of gladiatorially doomed quality figures in the dim passage have. After Pemulus has mysteriously won, he'll tell Mario maybe a Merino 350 with a diffusion filter on some kind of overhead cable you could winch along behind the figures at about twice the focal length, or else use fast film and station the Merino at the tunnel's very start and let the figures' backs gradually recede into a kind of doomed mist of low exposure.
I remember your guy as being one big forehand. Nothing but slice off the back. His vaps never varies. If you,